Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Okay, so moving on. The family afterward. Very excited. Chapter 9. Okay. So he says in the middle of the first paragraph there, right? He says, all members of the family should meet upon common ground of tolerance, understanding, and love. Okay. This involves a process of deflation. The alcoholic, his wife, his children, his quote-unquote in-laws, each one is likely to have fixed ideas about the family's attitude towards himself or herself. Each is interested in having his or her wishes respected. We find the more one member of the family demands that the others concede to him, the more resentful they become. This makes for discord and unhappiness. My experience was certainly that. In the outside world, in outside issues, they call that the identified patient. Okay, when you look at the structure of the family structure, that's the person who causes triangulation in relationships. That's the person who the entire family structure is based upon. And once they get into recovery, now there's a whole different set of rules that go along with that. Oftentimes, children and spouses say things like, I liked you better when you drunk, at least we knew where you were. These types of things. I mean, that's just one of the most... I mean, that just shows how alcoholism makes the family unit entirely sick, that the family unit would say, we liked you better when you were drunk. I mean, like, that's, like, how insidious is alcohol, right? Okay. So, and then he says, well, why? And why? Is it not because each wants to play the lead? Is not each trying to arrange the family show to his liking? Is he not unconsciously trying to see what he could take from the family rather than give? Which is pretty natural in the structure, family structure, right? Hey, look at this again. He says, cessation of drinking is but a first step away from a highly strained, abnormal condition. Okay, so it's not the end of the condition. It's a first step. Right? The doctor said to us, years of living with an alcoholic is almost sure to make any wife or children neurotic. The entire family is, to some extent, ill. Yeah, so it's our fault. I mean, really, that's how it works. You know, and people don't want to accept that. They don't think, oh, no, it's not really. Yes, it is. No, it's not. Yes, it is. No, it's not. You know, and whatever, right? Let families realize as they start their journey, right, that all will not be fair weather. Right? It doesn't get better. It gets worse. Each in his turn may be footsore and may struggle. There will be alluring shortcuts and bypaths down which they may wander and lose their way. Suppose we tell you some of the obstacles a family will meet. Suppose we suggest how they may be avoided, even converted to good use for others. The family of an alcoholic longs for the return of happiness and security. They remember when father was romantic, thoughtful, and successful. Today's life is measured against that of other years. When it falls short, the family may be unhappy. Now, I know that's a personal experience of mine. You know, I had, when I was sober almost 9 years, I had some outside issues come up. And as the result of that, the things that, how my life unfolded after that, was compared to my life previous to that. And I was accused of being lazy, accused of not wanting to work or not wanting to pull myself up by my bootstraps, you know, and just take it by the reins. You know, all the notions of things that were outside the realm of my control. Okay, so that was, in a way, you know, and then of course it was blamed on my alcoholism and not the real factor. So as the result of that, it took longer for me to get the proper help that I needed for that particular instance. Now, I don't know about anybody else, but I still do that. I still compare my life of today with the best portions of my life yet. Okay, so 12 years ago, 13 years ago, I was doing much better financially. I had more things. I owned my own home. You know, I had stuff. You know, things that I thought defined me and made me who I am. So I don't have those things now. So a lot of times I look at, you know, well, I'm not doing as well as I was. And then sometimes I look, well, you know, I'm doing actually a lot better than I was. And, you know, so it's always that flip-flop, that back-and-forth thing of like, how am I doing today? So I really, you know, it becomes like I need to stay focused on today sometimes, right? Family confidence in dad is rising high. The good old days will be back, they think. Sometimes they demand that dad bring them back instantly. God, they believe, almost owes them recompense on a long overdue account. But the head of the house has spent years in pulling down the structures of business, romance, friendship, health. These things are now ruined or damaged. It will take time to clear away the wreck. Though old buildings will eventually be replaced by finer ones, the new structures will take years to complete. Now, isn't that cool that he uses that phraseology in describing the process of recovery? Now, remember, he used that in knocking down that old dilapidated house and laying the foundation, putting cornerstones in place, building a new arch. The key to life and happiness, or the key to the future, is within the fourth step, and just all these wonderful structures, and he brings that back, okay? Because we were only just building a small base of that, right? So I mean, what do we have, really? We have some walls, a foundation, some walls, an unlocked door of an archway is ultimately what we have. I'm sure we want a nicer house than that. So it takes years of developing spirituality and spiritual growth for the new stones and new walls and new things to be placed within that. Right? So it's really cool that he puts that there. Father knows he is to blame. It may take him many seasons of hard work to be restored financially, but he shouldn't be reproached. Perhaps he will never have much money again, but the Wise family will admire him for what he is trying to be rather than what he's trying to get. Now, my experience, as I told you, it still is that way. My family insists that I should be rich by now, that with all my experience and all these things that I do and all these places that I speak, that I should at least be flush, that you know, I should be writing books and being asked to be on talk shows, and you know, for the wealth of knowledge that I've been given. And I, who knows, maybe that may one day happen, but it hasn't thus far. So it becomes, well, you know, you're just, and you should just, and well, you're not really. And it's like, well, how about climbing into my skeleton and my body, kind of like live there for a day? And then maybe you might get it. Maybe you won't. Right? Okay. So now and then, the family will be plagued by specters from the past. For the drinking career of almost every alcoholic has been marked by escapades, funny, humiliating, shameful, or tragic. The first impulse will be to bury these skeletons in the dark closet and padlock the door. The family may be possessed by the idea that the future happiness can be based only upon forgetfulness of the past. We think that such a view of self is self-centered and in direct conflict with the new way of living. How about that? Kind of goes against that forgive and forget thing, doesn't it? Okay. But again, there needs to be balance. Right? There needs to be balance. He's about to give us an example. Henry Ford once made a wise remark to the effect that experience is the thing of supreme value in life. That is true only if one is willing to turn to the past to good account. We grow by our willingness to face and rectify errors and convert them into assets. The alcoholic's past thus becomes the principal asset of the family, and frequently it is almost the only one. Right? The painful past may be of infinite value to other families still struggling with their problem. We think each family, which has been relieved, owes something to those who have not. When the occasion requires, each member of it should be only too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Showing others who suffer how we were given help is the very thing which makes life seem so worthwhile to us now. Right? Now here, these next statements are my favorite in the entire book. In the entire book, cling to the thought that in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have. The key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. That's the most powerful thing in this book. I have life experience. Not all is rosy. Even reason. And that, if I give that to God, God will give that back to me with a way that it will help other people not die and to not be miserable. And to say, listen, because we have this incredible dichotomy that we only listen to people who are quote-unquote successful. Right? And to me, I've been listening to tons of unsuccessful people for decades. Okay, I've watched a lot of people go do research and development who really didn't believe that they were true alcoholics, that they were real alcoholics, that they didn't have a manifestation of an allergy, and a phenomenon of craving, and they went out and they did that research for me. And they went out and they drank again, and they relapsed. Because they still didn't fully conceive. I watched that for years. Okay? I can't blame those people for doing that. If they turn that around and say, listen, I screwed up, I did it. In God's hands, they avert death and misery for me. Okay, so I can't judge my crap. Okay, because that's what I call it. My darkest past. Even my recent darkest past. I can't judge that as it being something that I don't want other people to know about for shame or for guilt. I need to give that to God and God, right? Because I do that in my 7-step prayer also. I give all of me to God, good and bad, and I ask in return for strength, right? To use me, to take away difficulties, to show people how I can overcome them through the power of God, through the power of God. God took away my alcoholism, took it away. A miraculous demonstration of that. I'm safe and protected. I don't swear it off. I don't fear it. The problem has been removed. Okay? But yet people doubt that. How long does it need to take? I need to die not picking up a drink in order for them, somebody to believe that? And then maybe they'll believe that years later? Because apparently 22 years of doing that is not enough. Because we have people within the media saying, well, you're never. And then they prove it. Right? By relapsing and dying and overdosing on drugs. And then people like me are pointed out like, what's he talking about? Okay? Because I'm part of the silent majority. I'm part of the silent majority. I know there are tons of people who are recovered, who have followed this process and this program and who live with God in their lives, with their mistakes, and pass that on to other people. And I don't know, for me, it's criminal to not tell people who are telling other people who are dying that you're never going to get over this. You're always going to be an alcoholic. I think that's a crime. It's a crime. Because it's just not true. If it were true, then okay. But it's just not true. I'm an example of that. I mean, I know people who died with over 50 years of sobriety. So what, they were an alcoholic until the end? No. They overcame alcoholism for over 50 years of their life. I mean, that's just incredible. That's 6 years longer than I'm alive. You know, and it's just, I don't understand. Like, we have, you know, there's a comedian out there who I like some of his musings. And he says, you know, tell millions of people that there's some invisible man in the sky who's going to do things for you or to you, and they buy it, right? But tell them that the paint is wet and they have to go over and touch it to see if it's true, okay? So it's kind of like that. That's what we are, right? We're kind of like the wet paint of the world, you know? So it becomes like we have to say to people, listen, I'm recovered. I don't have a problem with alcohol. I'm cured of alcoholism. And God did that. through this, God did that.
Oh, you didn't get...
Yeah, that's right, I do. Okay, and you can have it too. And that's really the difference. Because usually the people who are running around saying, don't drink, go to meetings, and you can never be recovered, and you can never be cured, are the people who are unwilling to help people achieve sobriety. They throw a meeting book at them or a meeting list and say, hey, I'll meet you here Saturday night. And then they get there and they want, you know, and they don't talk to them. Just, they don't give of themselves. They don't do this. They don't cling to the thought that their darkest past is the greatest possession they have. They're still ashamed of it. They still want to tuck it away. And they want to push it aside. And they want to say, yeah, but that was a different life. BS. That's my life. Current. You know, they say stupid things like, I want to keep my memory green. Well, you know, keeping my memory, you know, I haven't had a drink since May 1st of 1992. You know, like, I can remember situations, but I can't, you know, like, I don't remember physically feeling that way anymore. You know, because we tell people that when they get here. You don't have to feel like that ever again. Okay, but then once we do, once we say, you know what, I don't feel like that ever again, they go, oh, you think you're cured, you know. Okay, so I have God in my life. I have a higher power of my own understanding that gives me this, strength to stand up against criticism, to stand up against judgment, to stand up against finger pointing, to stand up against all of that, because God does all of that. I don't. I'm just an instrument. That's all God uses me to do that, right? All right, so he also says, it is possible to dig up past misdeeds so they become a blight, a veritable plague. For example, we know of situations in which the alcoholic or his wife have had love affairs. In the first flush of spiritual experience, they forgave each other and drew closer together. The miracle of reconciliation was at hand. Then, under one provocation or another, the aggrieved one would unearth the old affair and angrily cast its ashes about. A few of us have had these growing pains, and they hurt a great deal. Husbands and wives have sometimes been obliged to separate for a time until new perspective, new victory over old hurt pride could be rewon. In most cases, the alcoholic survived this ordeal without relapse, but not always. So we think that unless some good and useful purpose is to be served, past occurrences should not be discussed. Okay? Because we just... It's only a matter of time before we start believing the things that people tell us about ourselves. Okay? I say that to people. If I believed half of the things that people said about me, I would drink. Or I'd be dead. I would kill myself. Because that's their own projection. It has nothing to do with me. Okay, I know my inequities, I know my wrongs, I know what amends I've made, I know what amends I still have to make, and I have a relationship with God that I have on a daily basis, on a morning, a nightly, and throughout the day, I have that within my life. So I can walk with my head held high and not worry about my past. So it's my past. It's not up for anybody else to judge. Mine. Okay, so if I'm okay with it, and God's okay with it, it's not up to anybody else to not be okay with it. Okay, and that becomes a wholesale basis for discredit. Right? Well, you know what he did 13 years ago? No, I don't really want to know. Right? I don't really want to know what somebody did. Is that over? Did you make amends for that? Is it done? Like, all right, move on. You're still dragging that around? Obviously, you didn't give it to God. You still want to hold on to that. You still want to cling to that. So you need to do some 6- and 7-step work on it. Okay, so this stuff goes on. Okay, so when I walk around and I talk about being recovered and that God cured my alcoholism, people want to point to my humanness. Oh, yeah, but you still make mistakes. Well, where does it say that God's going to make me perfect? Matter of fact, it says quite the opposite. Spiritual progress, not perfection. Okay, but that miracle is sought in my life, right? And I have to carry that to other families. I have to carry that to other people. I have to carry it. I have to put it out there for inspection. Okay, I can't be one of the people who looks all shiny and new on the outside, but my life is just horrible, and I'm not going to tell you about it because then you're going to judge me, and then I really won't be sober, and I won't be this, and I can't do that, and I talk to this. I had somebody say that to me yesterday, as a matter of fact. Yesterday. On one of those social medias, I made a comment that they didn't like, and they took me to task on it. I said, well, sorry that you feel that way. I'm just reporting a fact. And it wasn't about feelings. It really was a fact. And they didn't like the fact that I was pointing out a fact, you know, because it hurt their feelings. And I said, well, you know, sorry it hurt your feelings. And if it does, I will abstain from making any further comments. So their response was, well, I unfriended you anyway, so that doesn't matter. I'm like, oh, okay, good. So I responded with, well, good, you saved me some time because I think most of you people are full of crap anyway. And then I got rid of them as well. So then they decided, well, you know, I want to engage. And they text me, and my response was, please do not contact me. Please do not contact me. I mean, those are pretty direct, simple instructions. But they ignored it, and they sent something else back. Where does it say that in the big book? You're a hypocrite. Those were the words that were sent to me. And my response was, we cannot be helpful to all, but God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of everyone. That was my answer. And I said, you know, I don't really have a use for this relationship anymore, and you can go bully somebody else. Because that's really what he was doing. He was trying to bully me for me pointing out something that was factual, that he didn't like, how that fact made him feel. So that fact was my fault. You see. So ultimately, that's part of what this process is talking about. Okay? Within the structure of the family, that's going to happen. The family is going to point out facts. Fact. Hey, Dad, you broke my favorite record. You broke the VCR. Hey, Mom, you did this. You know, these things, these are facts that are going to be pointed out. Okay? And we alcoholics don't like those facts a lot of time. Because we don't like how it makes us feel. And it says that further on in the page, right? It says it at the bottom of the page at 125. It says, we alcoholics are sensitive people. It takes some of us a long time to outgrow that serious handicap. Okay, so being sensitive is not an asset. It's a handicap. Right? Because we're talking about facts. You know, I was asked, how you doing? Oh, not good. Why? I'm feeling. And that was the truth. And it is the truth. I'm feeling today. And most of the time I don't like feeling because it takes me away from facts. Okay? So, you know, we're going to continue with the family afterwards. There's some more great things in here. Really important stuff later on in a few pages. But that's really it. It's, you know, presented with facts, people are going to react with feelings most of the time. Okay? So that's what we're dealing with within the family afterward, what we're putting out there. So we need to be wary of that when we're dealing with family of our own and dealing with families that we're working with, families of alcoholics that we're working with, that's what's going to happen. When we point out facts, people are going to have feelings about facts. And there's no getting around that. So, alrighty. So we're in the family afterward. We left off on page 125, sort of. It was one of the last things I mentioned. On the second to last paragraph of the page, it says, another principle we observe carefully is that we do not relate the intimate experiences of another person unless we are sure he would approve. Right? And that's really important for our 12-step work. And it's really important in general in AA because it falls under gossip is what happens. You know, despite somebody talking about their own stuff freely, it's really not up to us to go, hey, did you hear about Joe? He said this at the meeting, and Bob said that, and then Mary said that. You know, it's not really helpful to anybody, really. And my experience has been, generally what ends up happening is that as the result of that, the people whom expose themselves don't go back to those meetings anymore, and they refrain from sharing themselves. And trying to be open and helping other people. So that's a key element. And then he follows it. He says, we find it better, when possible, to stick to our own stories, right? Now, you know, there's that dichotomy, okay? Now, I've heard people talking about, you know, every time I try to talk to somebody, tell them about what's going on with me, they always start telling me about themselves. They just don't, you know, they never shut up. It's always about them, right? So it's really important to have that balance, you know? It's about, like, I don't know, for me, I think my experience is that alcoholics know more differently than other people in the world, have a one-upmanship thing that happens, right? You know, like somebody could, you all probably have someone or know somebody in your life that you could go and say, hey, guess what? I got great news. I got 2 tickets to paradise. And they say, well, I got a season pass. Yeah. You know, like, so it becomes that balance of, all right, well, we have to have that measure of listening. Not just hearing or waiting for our turn to talk, but really listening. You know, and that's a really key element to doing 12-step work. Because then we hear things that they may not have told other people, or they may not even realize that they're saying themselves, right? So, and then he goes on, he says, we alcoholics are sensitive people. And I think that's probably one of the truest statements in this entire book. You know, and of course you have the gamut of types of people within AA. You have the hand wringers that come in, you know, and everything, they're afraid of everything, and they want to, you know, and then you have the criers that just, I'm so grateful today that I'm sober, you know, and then you have the people, there's a guy out in California in LA, he's a famous actor, and he always talks, he's a little Mexican guy, and he talks about the scaredy cats in the back. He says, you see them, they're scaredy cats, they stand in the back of the room, they fold their arms like that, and they're all got tattoos, and they're really scaredy cats, because you probably go up and talk to them and they cry, you know, and you know who they are. They're the people, they come in and they still have that street bravado and that, like, listen, there are no tough guys in AA. There just aren't. There are people who may front themselves as tough guys. Tough guys are homeless people who live in Minnesota, Buffalo, and Chicago in the winter. Those are tough guys. You know, I'm not, like, I like heat. I like a bed. I like food. You know, I like to be comfortable. Like, you know, I stayed in my car like maybe 5 minutes longer because there was air conditioner in there. And I was like, oh, it's too hot. I'm not getting out. You know, like, I'm not a tough guy. You know, I stopped being a tough guy a long time ago. You know, because it didn't serve any purpose. And all it did was keep people away from me. Right? And then I complained. No one ever talks to me. Well, look at you. Of course they're not going to talk to you. You look like you're going to kill them. You know, it's like, no, I don't feel that way. You know, or... And then it's followed up by, you know, somebody pointing it out to me. Like, you know, you're pretty sensitive. And my answer is, what do you mean I'm sensitive? Okay, exactly, right? And, you know, Bill, he even says, it takes some of us a long time to outgrow that serious handicap. Right? It says that being sensitive is a serious handicap. Because what does it do? Okay, if we're sensitive, everything's about feelings. Okay? Now, you people hear me talk about this all the time. If we're going to get well, it needs to be about facts. It doesn't need to be about how we feel, right? Because feelings is what kept us drunk. We drank because of feelings. We were restless, irritable, and discontented. Feelings, right? And we needed a sense of ease and comfort that came at once from taking a few drinks so we could feel better. The facts of the matter are is that we're generally, like, malcontents, right? Right? We're discontented. We just don't like what's going on, right? So, and we're control freaks, so we can't do anything about it. So we just have to sit with what's going on, and that makes us irritable, right? And then we're restless because we don't want to stay right where we are. So we go, oh, I gotta get out of here, right? So most of us found alcohol that quieted all that crap, right? We had that sense of ease and comfort that, yeah. And then we didn't care what was going on. Or maybe we ranted about it and then passed out or something. You know, but it becomes that type of thing. It's a handicap. So being sensitive is a handicap. You know, and I know for me, when I'm being sensitive, I'm handicapped. Because I'm not hearing anything that you're saying to me. I'm ill-equipped to help anyone. I'm a ball of emotions.
I'm saying the 7 words that you can't say to Tim. Yeah, I know, but you don't understand. And in all different, you know, somebody will try to tell me some sort of fact that may be helpful to me. I'll say, well, yeah, I know, but you don't understand. You know, and I've become very adept at saying that same thing without saying those words. Right? I hear what you're saying. Let me tell you what I'm thinking. Right? It's the same thing. Yeah, I know, but you don't understand. Right? So, I need to be able to move from feelings. So when I'm in feelings, there's generally something wrong with my spiritual state. Right? There's generally I'm not connected to God. And that doesn't get, don't get me wrong, we aren't robots. Okay, but the problem with my feelings is that they're not appropriate to the size of the situation. Right? Like when I'm angry, it's usually not like I'm a little miffed or like I'm a little annoyed. I'm like really effing PO'd. You know what I mean? Like that's over here. You know, when I'm happy, it's generally not like, oh, this is, you know, like whistling or something. You know, I don't usually like stroll and whistle. You know, I'm usually like overexcited about it. I'm zealous about something. Isn't this great? You know, like, so most of the time, my emotions are not in direct proportion to the situation. Right? So the only thing that I have found that kind of keeps that me from going from the peaks and valleys of emotions and to the rolling lasagna hills is God, right? That relationship that I have with God. So if I'm in a particular feeling, you know, I always have to remember this too shall pass, regardless of what feeling it is. If I'm really happy, this too shall pass, right? If, you know, it's crappy, this too shall pass. And then maybe it'll come back. That's always the key, you know, like, that's always one of the things that people in AA get hung up on. Like, this too shall pass, and then it passes. And then they think it's gone forever. Like, I'm never going to feel that way again. No. You'll probably feel that way 10 minutes after it passes, depending on the situation, you know. So there needs to be some measure of that. And within the family afterward, it's good that he's putting it out there to families so they understand that about the alcoholic, that they're sensitive, that let's say, you know, mom or dad or the wife or the husband or the kids or whatever says, you know, you didn't clean this plate good enough, you know, and the appropriate response to that would be, oh, yeah, okay, I see. Yeah, well, here, let me clean it again. Oh, I'll do better next time. But usually what do alcoholics do? They take the plate and smash it against the wall, right? And they go, how about now? Is it clean? Right? Because that's what we do, because we're little kids shaking our rattles at the world when we get sober, right? So then he goes on and he says, many alcoholics are enthusiasts, right? They run to extremes. At the beginning of recovery, a man will take, as a rule, one of two directions. He may either plunge into a frantic attempt to get on his feet in business, or he may be so enthralled by his new life that he talks or thinks of little else. In either case, certain family problems will arise. With these, we have had experience galore, right? Some of you have probably experienced this. Some of you probably experienced this with people that you try to help. You know, as soon as they get sober, they're feeling a little better. Their head clears up. Now they're going to conquer the business world. Oh, I gotta go out, I gotta get a job, and I'm gonna work on Wall Street, and I'm gonna reinvent Wall Street, and you know, we kinda let them go. Like, okay, well, let me know when you crash, and I'll be here, and then maybe we could do some steps. Right. And then we have the other side of it. Then we have people who get involved in AA so deeply that nothing else matters. Right? Well, you know, Bobby has a concert tonight. I can't be there, I have my home group tonight. You need to be at Bobby's concert, man. You know, you can't replace being irresponsible with drinking and doing the wrong things with being irresponsible in AA. Okay? So there's that balance. We're constantly looking for balance, right? So then he even gives the warning in the next paragraph. He says, we think it dangerous if he rushes headlong in his economic problem. The family will be affected also, pleasantly at first, as they feel their money troubles are about to be solved. Then, not so pleasantly, as they find themselves neglected. Dad may be tired at night and preoccupied by day. He may take small interest in the children, and he may show irritation when reproved for his delinquencies. If not irritable, he may seem dull and boring, not gay and affectionate as the family would like him to be. Mother may complain of inattention. That's a personal... Bill experienced that with Lois. That was a constant thing that he did. He neglected her constantly, and she writes about it, and lets us all know that. They are also disappointed, and often let him feel it, right? They let him feel it. You disappointed me. I'm going to let you feel it, right? Beginning with such complaints, a barrier arises. He is straining every nerve to make up for lost time. He is striving to recover fortune and reputation and feels he is doing very well. I'm doing very well. I'm going to work every day. I'm bringing a paycheck home. I'm here. I'm not drunk. Right? Then what happens next? He says, sometimes mother and children don't think so. You think you're doing well? You know. And that's the typical reaction, right? So then he says, having been neglected and misused in the past, they think father owes them a lot more than they are getting. They want him to make a fuss over them. They expect him to give them nice times that he used to have before he drank so much, and to show his contrition for what they suffered. But dad doesn't give freely of himself. Resentment grows. He becomes still less communicative. Sometimes he explodes over a trifle. You know, like the dirty plate, right? The family is mystified. They criticize, pointing out how he is falling down on his spiritual program. Now, I experienced that early in recovery because, you know, what ends up happening, and I know you know this expression, a little knowledge can be dangerous. So what ends up happening is that the family members get some knowledge of what AA is and what it's supposed to be, and that we're supposed to be living a spiritual life, and we're supposed to be more God-centered, and we're not supposed to be the people that we were before drinking. But the problem is that it's not an overnight matter. Okay? It's not, I quit drinking and poof, I'm the person you want me to be. Right? That just doesn't work that way. Okay, so then he gives some advice. He says, this sort of thing can be avoided. Both father and family are mistaken, though each side may have some justification. Some, right? It is of little use to argue and only makes the impasse worse. Right? There's that expression that I'm sure everyone in AA has heard. Would you like to be right or would you like to be happy? And my answer is always, well, I'm quite happy, but I'm right. So the family must realize that dad, though marvelously improved, is still convalescing. Okay, he's still feeling the effects of his alcoholism, physically, mentally, spiritually. He's not there yet, right? Okay, they should be thankful he is sober and able to be of this world once more. Let them praise his progress. Let them remember that his drinking wrought all kinds of damage that may take long to repair. If they sense these things, they will not take so seriously his periods of crankiness, depression, or apathy, which will disappear when there is tolerance, love, and spiritual understanding. Okay, now, that sounds very noble, and what a wonderful Norman Rockwell picture that was painted, right? But that's good advice for us as people who are working with other alcoholics as well, okay? When we're dealing with newcomers, when we're dealing with people who are untreated, they're cranky. They're depressed. They don't care. Right? That's their general feeling. I don't care. You know, it's just, what's the matter with you? I'm depressed. Okay? So, if we combat that with, well, what are you depressed about? Well, why don't you care? Well, what are you cranky about? If we're hitting it with the same kind of frothy emotional appeal that's talked about in the doctor's opinion, little is going to be done. But when we're tolerant and we have spiritual understanding and we offer love and we offer patience, a lot of times what ends up happening is that the person who is going through that starts to talk a little more. They start to communicate their feelings more. And they're open to hearing a solution to their problem. Okay? And one of the greatest examples of that expression is, well, do you want to live in the problem or do you want to live in the solution? You know, and invariably everybody says, well, I want to live in the solution. But they're full of crap. They really don't. You know, some days they just want to bitch. Some days they just want to be depressed. Some days they just want to not care. Right? Some days they just want to be cranky. So the loving thing to do is to say, all right, well, let me know when you're done with that. I'll be here. Have fun.
We know how that works out for you. How's that working for you? So if we're presenting it that way, we're giving spiritual understanding, right? Because we are that person also. We're no different than the person who feels that way, because on any given day, I mean, that's one of my favorite expressions, is thank God we're not all sick on the same day. Right? Because we have measures of regardless of being recovered or how much sober time you have, you're going to have human days. And then there's going to be somebody else who may not be as sober as long as you are, or may not be recovered as long as you are, but they're having a very spiritual day. Okay? And that could help you. So it's really important not to be like, how long are you sober?
Oh, yeah, nothing to say. You know, like, for every year that you accumulate, you know, you're drawing a line, and anybody with less time than that just kind of doesn't count. You know, that's, so what ends up happening when you do that is you have less and less people to talk to. Okay, because it's rare to accumulate time in recovery, believe it or not. So there's a lot more, I talk to a lot more people who have less time than I do than more. You know, that's just the reality of it. So it's really important to bring this into our own programs in recovery, right? So here's what's important too. Here's a little confessional from Billy. It says, the head of the house ought to remember that he is mainly to blame for what befell his home. Fact. Fact. He's mainly to blame. Okay? And most people, most alcoholics, are sensitive, and they don't want to hear that. They don't want to hear that it's their fault, that mom and the kids are screwed up. Well, it is. They're mainly to blame. So then it becomes like, okay. So then he says he can scarcely square the account in his lifetime. But, right, here's the warning. He must see the danger of over-concentration on financial success. Although financial recovery is on the way for many of us, we found we could not place money first. For us, material well-being always followed spiritual progress. It never preceded. Right? I've watched that happen all the time. I'm sure most people have experienced this too. You know, somebody gets that dream job and they're ready to go, and then their spiritual stuff starts to fall off. The things that they were doing that got them that dream job start to fall off. Oh, I don't have time. I got this job and I'm working too much, so I can't really afford to be going to as many meetings or helping as many people or doing as much, you know, in AA, not understanding that that's the girl they took to the dance in the first place. So they kind of like start ignoring it. And then what happens? They, you know, if they're single, they find him or they find her. And now, as I like to say, they have a new higher power. Okay, so now you got the job, and now you got the new higher power, you know. And then what's next? You get the place, too. You get the place you always wanted to live. And that's like the trifecta. And inevitably, what ends up happening is that the spiritual stuff goes out the window. That's not first. God is always has to be first. I heard this plenty of times. It's happened in my life. I believe it 100%. Whatever we put in front of our recovery, God is going to take away. Whatever it is. Family, jobs, him, her, stuff, whatever it is. God takes it away. I've never seen it fail. Never. Never seen it fail. It may take longer for some people than others. But, you know, whatever somebody puts ahead of their recovery, God takes it away. So, for me, God needs to be first. It's always God, then recovery, and then everything else. So the highest anybody is ever going to get on the list is third. Okay? And the unfortunate reality of that is that most of the women that I date are in recovery and they're in AA and they don't like being third. You know, because they want to be first. You know, me, then God, and then you. You know, it's like, sorry, it doesn't work that way. Oh, well, you're Mr. Spiritual, aren't you? So these are some of the things that go on, right? So he says, since the home has suffered more than anything else, it is well that a man exert himself, right? He is not likely to get far in any direction if he fails to show unselfishness and love under his own roof, right? So I'm sure you experienced this. You know people who are, they're in AA and they're paragons of recovery in the rooms. And at home, they're like the same drunk that they were. They're selfish with their family. I, me, and then, you know, and the relationships are still broken and they're still dead. So
I had a sponsor that he passed last year. He died of cancer, and he died with 23 years of sobriety, and I met his son for the first time. And I said, oh, yeah, he was my sponsor. He was a good man. And he said he had his moments. After 23 years of recovery, right? Like, so what happened there? What amends weren't made? You know, did he make amends? And his son is still, like, but this man often shared that he had regrets with his family and he felt that nothing could ever be done about it. And obviously, it was true to some extent because that was the reaction that I get from his son, like, the first time I meet him. He had his moments. Wow. After 23 years, he could scarcely square the account in his lifetime. Right? That's sad. So, we know there are difficult wives and families, but the man who is getting over alcoholism must remember he did much to make them so. So he repeated it again. Right? You're the one who caused this problem, so knock it off. Right? Each member of a resentful family begins to see his shortcomings and admits them to the others. He lays a basis for helpful discussion. These family talks will be constructive if they can be carried on without heated argument, self-pity, self-justification, or resentful criticism. Little by little, mother and children will see they ask too much, and father will see he gives too little. Giving rather than getting will become the guiding principle. And it's just, I think we just saw, like, the premise for Father Knows Best. Or, you know what I mean? Like, the 50s sitcoms going on. So, like, okay, yeah, this is an ideal that we're trying to achieve. But, you know, we are dealing with recovering alcoholics and recovered alcoholics who, our nature is that we're selfish and self-centered. So, that rubs off on other people. Okay? When we're like that, other people start to become like that around us. And then they start to say, well, you're like it. How come? What's the problem? I can't be like that. Only you could be like that. And then, you know, because our wives, our husbands, our children, our parents, they all know how to push our buttons. Right? They probably installed them in the first place. So the trick is to get God to cut those buttons. So, again, it has to be about dealing with facts. And if feelings come up, they need to be acknowledged and saying, okay, I'm feeling this way, and perhaps we can talk about this some other time. You know, communication is huge, right? Okay, assume, on the other hand, that Father has, at the outset, a stirring spiritual experience. Are you ready for this? Overnight, as it were, he is a different man. He becomes a religious enthusiast. He is unable to focus on anything else. As soon as his sobriety begins to be taken as a matter of course, the family may look at their strange new dad with apprehension, then with irritation. There is talk about spiritual matters, morning, noon, and night. He may demand that the family find God in a hurry, or exhibit amazing indifference to them, and say that he is above worldly considerations. He may tell mother, who has been religious all her life, that she doesn't know what it's all about, and that she had better get his brand of spirituality while there is still yet time. I experienced that, certainly in my house. My father did that for sure. And then you had the extra added bonus that I was in recovery at the same time. So then it was always, oh boy, you know, that's just listen, it goes back to the same thing that we talk about in personal recovery. Somebody's God is their own business. How they deal to have a relationship with that higher power is their own business. If they're having a relationship with their higher power, that's wonderful. If they're not, encourage them to do so. And then shut up. You know, because it doesn't matter. Like, oh, well, you don't know, and yet, oh, and just, oh my God. But, you know what I mean? It just becomes like, and that's a wonderful description. Like, she's been religious her whole life, but she doesn't know what it's all about. You know, or else she would have been able to get me sober, you know, because you got that stuff too, right? So, okay, when Father takes this tack, the family may react unfavorably. Imagine that. Now check this. It says, they may be jealous of a God who has stolen Dad's affections. While grateful that he drinks no more, are you ready for this? They may not like the idea that God has accomplished the miracle
where they failed.
Ooh,
controversy. God created a miracle of recovery where humans fail. It says it right there in the book. I'm not making it up. There it is. Right? They often forget Father was beyond human aid. They may not see why their love and devotion did not straighten him out. That is not so spiritual after all, they say. If he means to right his past wrongs, why all this concern for everyone in the world but his family? What about his talk that God will take care of them? They suspect Father is a bit balmy, right? He's not so unbalanced as they may think. Many of us have experienced Dad's elation. We have indulged in spiritual intoxication. Spiritual intoxication. That's heavy-duty words right there, man. I guarantee, if you haven't experienced it yet in AA, you will. And you may experience it yourself. Right? That, nothing matters but God. All about God, and you pray, and you're pious, and you meditate in God, and I have to go down to the river and pray because I feel close to him there, and the sunrise and the sunset, and no, I don't have time for you. You know, like, man, what are you talking about? Like, get to work and help somebody. But that intoxication it's incredible because it's an overindulgence, right? Intoxication, meaning being poisoned, in poison. That's what intoxicated means. You're in poisoned. Okay, so if you have too much God, you're going to be poisoned by it. Right? We all know people who are like that. They run around and they tell us that our brand of God is wrong, and if you don't believe this, and you're wrong, and you're going to hell, and oh my God. Good luck. God bless, right? Like a gaunt prospector, belt drawn in over the last ounce of food, our pick struck gold. Joy at our release from a lifetime of frustration knew no bounds. Father feels he has struck something better than gold. For a time he may try to hug the new treasure to himself. He may not see it at once that he has barely scratched a limitless load. Limitless load. Which will pay dividends. Conditional. Only if he minds it for the rest of his life and insists on giving away the entire product. Wow. Can't keep any of it. Can't keep it. Got to give it away. All the time. When you're fearing spiritual, you better go help somebody else. Immediately. And it's limitless. As long as you continue to mind it. You can't stop. It's got to go on, right? Okay, if the family cooperates, Dad will soon see that he is suffering from a distortion of values. He will perceive that his spiritual growth is lopsided. That for an average man like himself, a spiritual life which does not include his family obligations may not be so perfect after all. Right? I say that all the time to people. How are you doing with your family? Where are they in your life? Are you spending time with your family? Are you having dinner with your family? Are you going to your children's events? Are you there? Are you having conversations with your wife in the morning, at night? Are you making time to have couple time? Are you doing these types of things? That's important. Those are spiritual things. Those are mining your gold and giving it away to other people. Right? Most of you know I'm not a meeting guy. You know, I need a meeting. All right, I'll give you an example. I was at a friend's house Saturday night, and her and her husband are having a hard time getting out because they have a one-year-old child. And I said, well, you need to ask for help, and we'll be here, and I'll come and babysit. And there's other people. And yeah, I know, but you don't understand what I got. And another woman who's the wife of another guy in the program showed up, and her and then my friend, the three of us were talking, and she's talking about she's having medical issues and medical struggles. And her husband at this point is like, wah, and shaking his rattle. Right? And he's not being there emotionally, being the emotional support for his wife. And she articulated that quite clearly. She says, I feel that I can't be in crisis and have my thing going on because your crisis is more important than my crisis. Which is 100% true. I know this guy a long time, and it's 100% true. He's one of the season pass kind of guys, right? So he's sitting there, and he's in anguish. He's in anguish. I can feel him sitting next to me in anguish. Why? Because he needs a meeting. He needs a meeting. Right? Instead of, after his wife just said, I need emotional support from you. I need a meeting. He's sober 16 years. Right? So the other woman said, you're at a meeting. Okay? Because three of us are in recovery, and his wife is one of the best Al-Anons I've ever met who never attended Al-Anon. Okay? Right? So it's like, oh, listen, he said, I don't know what to do, I don't know what to do, I don't know what to do, and he's like a friggin' hamster on a wheel and wringing his hand, I don't know what to do. Why? Because he's driven by self, right? Because he's driven by self-delusion and self-seeking and self-pity and fear. Whoa, what's going to happen if I don't get to a meeting? Crap, right? So I looked, I don't know what to do, I don't know what to do. So I turned to him and I simply said, well, why don't you ask God what to do? And shockingly, and I even said this, I said, thank God I was sitting down when he said this. He said, you know what? You're right. That's a good idea. I mean, really, I sat back in my chair. I couldn't believe he said it, right? So he said, the whole time, still, like, seething. He's like, seething angst, right? So he finally goes, so then he says to his wife, he says, well, what do you think? She says, well, I don't want you to go, but you do whatever you want. That's the proper Al-Anon response, for sure, right? You asked me, I don't want you to go, but you do what you want. So within 5 minutes, he gets say, oh, I'm going to a meeting. Right? So he goes to give her a kiss goodbye, and she doesn't give him a kiss. He's like, thanks. She's like, what? I said goodbye, have fun. So I queried, I said, well, why don't you give him a kiss? She said, I didn't feel like it. I said, oh, okay. See, because and I was more, no, I wasn't judgmental. I was gathering information. See, because for me, when I'm in a relationship, I look at it from the perspective of no matter how annoyed we are at each other, if we're leaving each other's presence, we say goodbye, we say I love you, and we kiss. Just in case one of us dies. Okay? I like to hedge my bets, you know what I mean? And not go to bed angry, you know, those types of things. So that's why I was asking. I said, you don't have that rule? She says, no, not really. I said, oh, okay. So it was really interesting to watch somebody at 16 years of recovery still in a place where this is not happening. That a spiritual life which does not include his family obligations may not be so perfect after all. And he probably went to the meeting and talked about how important it was for him to get to that meeting. Right? I just spent the whole day with my family, and I mean, there was a whole drama going on, you know. And it's just, it always amazes me that, listen, don't get me wrong. I think it's wonderful if somebody feels that they need to go to meetings and help people all the time. That's great. But if you have a family that is telling you, I need you, and you're saying, well, okay, well, I need to take care of me before I take care of you. Oh man, you're just way off the beam. You know, so that was it's amazing. I just love that God does those things, puts those wonderfully practical examples in my life so it's not just words on paper, that I could share that with you people, right? Okay? So then he says, if the family will appreciate that Dad's current behavior is but a phase of his development, all will be well. In the midst of an understanding and sympathetic family, these vagaries of Dad's spiritual infancy will quickly disappear. Well, some quicker than others, and sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, right? Okay. At the bottom of the page, it says, instead of treating the family as he should, he may retreat further into himself and feel he has spiritual justification for doing so. And I just illustrated a great example, right? Though the family does not fully agree with Dad's spiritual activities, they should let him have his head. Okay? And that's exactly what this woman did. All right, whatever. Even if he displays a certain amount of neglect and irresponsibility toward the family, it is well to let him go as far as he likes in helping other alcoholics. During those first days of convalescence, this will do more to ensure his sobriety than anything else. Though some of his manifestations are alarming and disagreeable, we think Dad will be on firmer foundation than the man who is placing business or professional success ahead of spiritual development. Right? Now, what's interesting in that statement, right, they're discussing somebody who has just entered recovery, who has just gone through the process of the steps, Now, if you notice, it says, during those first few days of convalescence, he will do more to ensure his sobriety than anything else. Working with other alcoholics. Okay? How many alcoholics do we know that work with other alcoholics in the first few days of their convalescence? Generally not. I mean, that's how far away from this as a whole AA has come. You know, because back then they were like, oh, do you want what we have? Okay, we'll tell you what we have. Okay, no? All right, bye. Oh, you do? Okay, this is what you're going to do. And they were through the step process. There was no like, oh, I have to wait 30 days. My sponsor doesn't think I'm ready for a first step. There was none of that crap going on. You were dying. You're dying. Do you want to die? No, you don't want to die? Okay, this is what you need to do to live. You must do these things. Okay. Right? In the middle of the page, on 130, it says, we have come to believe he would like us to keep our heads in the clouds with him, but that our feet ought to be firmly planted on earth. Right? That is where our fellow travelers are, and that is where our work must be done. These are the realities for us. Right? Facts. They're facts. Okay, so it goes back and it reiterates faith without works is dead. It reiterates that, yeah, God is great, and God is great to... But, you know, you need to go to work. You know, God's going to provide. But you need to do the Goya program, as I always like to say. You know the Goya program, right? Get off your ass. That's the Goya. So, now here's the next paragraph. He says, one more suggestion, colon. Well remembered. Whether the family has spiritual convictions or not, they may do well to examine the principles by which the alcoholic member is trying to live. They could hardly fail to approve these simple principles, though the head of the house still fails somewhat in practicing them. Right? So, of course, he's talking about, you know, our sister fellowship and other fellowships that sort of bolster this. I mean, like, there's over 800 that have rewritten the steps for their particular purposes. So we know that 12-step recovery works. Okay, like three-quarters of the way down on page 131, it says, Father will necessarily spend much time with other alcoholics, but this activity should be balanced. Okay? Again, should be balanced. New acquaintances who know nothing of alcoholism might be made and thoughtful consideration given their needs. The problems of the community might engage attention. Though the family has no religious connections, they may wish to make contact with or take membership in a religious body. Now, the nice thing about what AA has done over the years is that we have things outside the group. We have things outside the process of sponsor-to-sponsee relationship for that. We have AA activities, sober activities that go on that people as a family can get involved in. Sober picnics that go on. Districts have them. Areas have them. Intergroups have them. Some people are like, I'm going to one on Labor Day, which has been going on for 29 years since the guy got sober. He's had a Labor Day picnic and a Memorial Day picnic every year. And they're just wonderful, and they're open to everybody. And if you want, I'll give you the address. Take a ride down. He never has a problem with that. Oh yeah, you're new? Hey, great, come on. And he'll tell you the whole story, you know. So, and they're always a lot of fun. Right? Okay, page 132. 132. Ooh, we're getting to some really good stuff that I love on these pages, right? Okay. In the middle of the page, that first full paragraph, it says, we have been speaking to you of serious, sometimes tragic things. We have been dealing with alcohol in its worst aspect. But we are in a glum lot. If newcomers could see no joy or fun in our existence, they wouldn't want it. You ready for this? I like this, Tim. It says, we absolutely insist on enjoying life. Isn't that amazing? We insist on it. Absolutely. Like, that's so typical alcoholic, though, isn't it? You know, like, most people are like, you know, I'd really like to enjoy life. You know, it'd be nice. I'll go to work and have a... You know, not us. We're like, I'm going to enjoy life, damn it! Right? And so it's just funny to me. We try not to indulge in cynicism over the state of the nations. Nor do we carry the world's trouble on our shoulders. When we see a man sinking into the mire, that is alcoholism, we give him first aid and place what we have at his disposal. Right? So we give him first aid. We don't take him to a meeting and give him a cup of coffee. We take him to a detox. Or we take him to an emergency room. Unless there's somebody in the meeting who's willing to babysit them and take them through their detox process. Okay, but that doesn't go on a lot anymore. So that's what we do. We give them first aid, and then we place what we have to offer. We have this program of recovery that requires a God and will help you overcome your drinking. Then we have a fellowship of people who hopefully have gone through that process themselves and who have experienced that.
And who will love you till you can love yourself anyway, so why don't you come on in?
The insanity is warm.
Okay.
And then here, this is important. This is the antithesis. You hear this in other middle-of-the-road meetings. You hear this in the don't drink and go to meetings. And this is the opposite of, I'm tired of hearing all those war stories. Right? It says, for his sake, we do recount and almost relive the horrors of our past. Okay? So we tell about our stories. We say, hey, this is what I did. But we need to make sure that we're telling him what happened and what it's like now. You know, and that's generally what we miss in speaker meetings. Because most of the time, speaker meetings are what it was like, and what it was like, and what it was like, and I got sober, and I'm in AA, thank you.
Right? Oh, yeah, that's great. That was a great story, wasn't it?
I'm like, no, there's God. He's a crazy person.
Oh, you're just critical.
Yes, I am. Thank you for the fact. Okay. Right? But those of us who have tried to shoulder the entire burden and trouble of others, find we are soon overcome by them, right? You know those people who, like, they don't want anybody else talking to their sponsees, right? That's my sponsee, won't you talk to them? And they, you just listen to me, you just listen to me. And those people are insane. They're worse than the newcomers, right? Because you watch them and they start going, oh my God, my newcomer's doing this. Hey, you know, if you want some help, no, I got it. Oh, you got it already, you know? Okay. So, this is wonderful. I love this. So we think cheerfulness and laughter make for usefulness. Right? I laugh all the time, as much as I can in meetings. It annoys people how much I laugh in meetings and joke around. People used to give me looks, especially in LA. They used to give me, you know, I had long hair too, so that was even worse. They'd give me the looks like, I'm like, the library is right down the street. You know, you're talking, shut up. Go away. You know, because I'm not going to be that miserable person. I was looking for that. You know, I told you that plenty of times. I wasn't going to be a miserable old curmudgeon. And sit, like, if I'm going to be that, I'm going to go drink. I'm going to be miserable, I'm going to go drink, right? And then what does it say here? Outsiders are sometimes shocked when we burst into merriment over a seemingly tragic experience out of the past. Right? How many times do we do that? We hear people tell this ridiculous drunk story that only alcoholics get. Right? You're thinking of one right now. Right? And then you tell the story, and we all burst into laughter, and people who are not alcoholics go, that's not funny. And we're like, yeah, it is. Right? Okay? And then he says, you ready for this? He says, but why shouldn't we laugh? And here it comes. We have recovered and have been given the power to help others. Wow. That's awesome, right? See, I didn't make it up. It's in the book. Okay. Everybody knows that those in bad health and those who seldom play do not laugh much. And we love when people are new like that. Because we're like, hey, they're new. How do you know? Because we know that scowl. Right? We know how miserable life was, right? So let each family play together or separately as much as their circumstances warrant. Are you ready? This is great. I love that he puts this in here. We are sure God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. We cannot subscribe to the belief that this life is a vale of tears, though it once just was that for many of us. But it's clear we made our own misery. Fact. It's not a feeling, it's a fact. We made our own misery. God didn't do it. Right? And here, this is great. I love this. This is one of my favorites. It says, avoid then the deliberate manufacture of misery. You all have one of those people in your life. who just deliberately manufactures misery. Doesn't matter. It could be the greatest day in the world and not come along and pee in your Cheerios. You know, that's just going to happen. Okay? He says, but if trouble comes, cheerfully capitalize it as an opportunity to demonstrate his omnipotence. Right? You all know Grace, my car. Right? You all know that story. That trouble came. Right? And I wasn't like, right? Then the car broke down on a Tuesday, the van broke down on a Wednesday, the next Monday I was here with Grace. Right? That was God. I capitalized that terrible, awful situation and gave you a wonderful story. Right? Isn't that cool? So then, this is a key element here too. He says, now about health, colon. A body badly burned by alcohol does not often recover overnight, nor do twisted thinking and depression vanish in a twinkling. What's the matter with you? You quit drinking a week ago. Yeah, I quit drinking a week ago. Like, that's... Okay. He says, we are convinced that a spiritual mode of living is a most powerful health restorative. Right? Hey, look what he says here. We, who have recovered from serious drinking. Hey, recovered. Imagine that. Are miracles of mental health. Mental health, right? Alcoholism is a mental illness that God cures through a miracle. That's what we are. We're miracles of mental health, right? But we have seen remarkable transformations in our own bodies, in our bodies. Hardly one of our crowd now shows a mark of dissipation. Right? You know, people, they get home, like they were a mess. They were yellow. They had jaundice. They were just a wreck. And they transform. They transform. And you look, like, that's one of the greatest compliments I ever get in my life. When somebody says, I can't imagine you with the drinking problem. I'm like, wow. It's like, would you like some phone numbers? Because I could give you some, right? So it's really cool. And then he says, but this does not mean we disregard human health measures, right? You know, all the people in AA who tell you don't take the pills for this and don't take the pills for that, right? And he says, God has abundantly supplied this world with fine doctors, psychologists, and practitioners of various kinds. Do not hesitate to take your health problems to such persons, right? That's AA's opinion about it. Most of them give freely of themselves, that their fellows may enjoy sound minds and bodies. Try to remember that though God has wrought miracles among us, we should never belittle a good doctor or psychiatrist. Now that's important. I say this all the time. A good doctor and a good psychiatrist. Because there's a lot of idiots that give alcoholics who just quit drinking, who are, you know, they're nervous and they're anxious about things. That's okay. Here's some Ativan. That's okay. Here's some Klonopin. Here's some Xanax. Those aren't good doctors. They're not good doctors. They know nothing about alcoholism or addiction if that's what they're doing. So it's important to make clear, right? Okay, then he says, their services are often indispensable in treating a newcomer and in following the case afterward, right? Now, on the next page, 135. Right? The top of the page says, whether the family goes on a spiritual basis or not, the alcoholic member has to if he would recover. Okay? So that's AA's opinion. They have to. You want to recover? You need spirituality. You need God. Okay. Then it tells a nice story about the wife nagging him about drinking coffee and smoking too much, and he drinks. Right? Now you all know how I feel about that kind of crap. Okay. So then he says what he needs to do. Right? He says he had to painfully admit, because he was wrong, dead wrong. He had to painfully admit that and mend his spiritual fences. Though he is now a most effective member of Alcoholics Anonymous, he still smokes and drinks coffee. But neither his wife nor anyone else stands in judgment. She sees she was wrong to make a burning issue out of such a matter. Are you ready for this? Are you ready for this? This is so important right here. It says, when his more serious ailments were being rapidly cured. Cured. His alcoholism was being cured. Yes, that says it right here on page 135 in the big book, in the book called Alcoholics Anonymous. Right? So then he says, we have three little mottos which are apropos. here they are, : first things first, live and let live, easy does it. Okay? So, once again, my, zeal, my gusto, my insistence that we can become recovered and cured is right there in black and white. I didn't write this book. Oh my God, do I wish I had. But I can read and I can comprehend. And that's what it says. Yeah, the coffee problem and the smoking problem haven't been cured. But his alcoholism is being rapidly cured. Cured! Rapidly. Awesome, right? All right, so next week I'm going to start on the Chapter 2 employers, which is so key that if you're working with other people and you're doing 12-step work, you need to pay attention to Chapter 10 because there's so much stuff in here about sponsorship that's never talked about. So that's it for this week. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.